From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, this is Newsmakers. I'm Maureen McCollum. Nobel Prize-winning astrophysicist John Mather grew up during the space race between the United States and the Soviet Union in the 1950s and 60s. But it was growing up around farming, and not astronomy, that piqued his interest in a life of science. Mather's work in helping launch the Kobe satellite in 1989 led to winning the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1996. The work helped measure radiation from the Big Bang, something once thought to be impossible to determine. Wisconsin Public Radio's John Davis had a chance to talk with Dr. Mather when he visited UW La Crosse last fall. He asked Mather how he became interested in science.
I think I got interested in science when I was about 6 or 7 years old, maybe. I can sort of remember hearing about infinity and discovering that, yes, it's possible you can cover an entire page with zeros and make a bigger number and bigger. And I remember asking my dad about life. And he told me that bodies are made out of cells with chromosomes in them. And he was a geneticist working on dairy cows. In fact, he had his degree from Madison to work on that. So he has his degree in animal husbandry. So I was living on the research farm of Rutgers University. So anyway, I was surrounded by science, even though I didn't really know anything about what they were doing. So I remember also going to the Museum of Natural History in New York and seeing the wonderful planetarium show and seeing the dinosaur bones and how everything was laid out to show the history of the fossils. And I thought, well, this is just thrilling. And later on, of course, went back more than once and heard more about the mysteries of the universe. Anyway, I wanted to know more.
So why astrophysics as opposed to some other form of science?
Well, I was interested in astronomy as a kid, and it was something you could read about and do something about in the country. I looked at the sky. I had binoculars and a small telescope made out of cardboard tubes and little lenses from the catalog. And so that was something I could work on and read about. Then in college, I thought I'll be study physics and elementary particles because that was the great mystery of that time. You know, the fundamental nature of matter was being explored, and that's what I want to do. Then I got to grad school, and I thought, well, what am I going to do now? And I said, well, I'm interested in this theoretical particle physics business, but they said, well, that's interesting, but there are no jobs available. Are you independently wealthy? No, I'm not. So I go around and interview people who are working on something that might be interesting, and I've interviewed a couple, and I found these guys that were working on measuring the cosmic microwave background radiation, which is the remnant of the early universe. And so, okay, well, I'll try to measure that. That's my thesis project. So that was how we got into that in a serious way. So it's really coming at it from the side of physics with all the technology and tools that physics labs have and then applying it to this great cosmic question. The cosmic background radiation had only just recently been discovered at that time. It was discovered in 65, and it was looking for a project in 1970. So almost nothing was known yet. So it was a wide-open topic.
Did the space program inspire you?
Not very much at the time.
Really?
Not very much at the time, because the part that I heard about was not the science part. It was just the people in space part. And I was impressed, but I wasn't paying much attention. So I didn't know how hard it was. But I felt also the advantage to me as a science student was that suddenly the country knew that scientists and engineers were going to save the country from the Soviet Union's threat, which we sort of did. And so suddenly when there had been almost no public interest in science, suddenly there were science fairs and science courses and things to do for youngsters everywhere. So that was tremendous for me.
You shared the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2006. Could you talk a little bit about the work?
Yeah.
That was behind the work that prize was that you were honored with?
Yeah, we built the Cosmic Background Explorer satellite. This was a follow-on to my thesis project at Berkeley, plus several other experiments. Eventually it got whittled down to a total of three. We were going to try to measure this heat radiation from the Big Bang even much, much, much better than it had ever been done before. So that was in 1974 that we started thinking about it. NASA solicited proposals for new satellite missions. It was just 5 years after the moon landing. So this puts us a long time back. They were already aware that the manned program was winding down, at least as far as moon landings was concerned. So what are we going to do that's really exciting? Well, science could be it. And so our team put in a proposal in 74, and 150 other teams did too. So suddenly NASA was overwhelmed by the number of things that people could do in outer space in science. So we were very lucky in many ways that they recognized that our idea was good and they supported it. And finally, in 89, the project was launched into space and it immediately started taking good data. So what did we find? We measured two really important things. One is we measured the spectrum of the background radiation and we compared it with the prediction of the Big Bang Theory. And it matched perfectly. So this was a really strong confirmation that that's the right story to tell. It's not really the right word. Big Bang is not something that conveys the correct scientific interpretation. We didn't actually observe a bang. We observed that the universe is expanding. So there wasn't a bang, as far as I'm concerned. Mm-hmm. The other thing that we measured was that this radiation is not equally bright in every direction. And it's got little lumps in it. Which we now understand as the reason we exist. Those are the places that were hotter or colder or less dense and more dense than the average. And the ones that were more dense are the ones that are going to stop expanding and turn into galaxies. So we were able to observe in the remnant of the early universe signs of what would turn into people and stars. So Stephen Hawking saw that picture and he said that was the most important scientific discovery of the century, if not of all time. I thought, that's really wonderful that he thinks that, although to tell you the truth, I might have chosen something else. I gradually began to appreciate that, yeah, it really, really, really is important because it explains a tremendous mystery. It's something that most people had never dreamed we could ever find. That was a wonderful surprise.
What would you have chosen?
I probably would have gone back at least a few centuries to see something that was really important, like the discovery of relativity theory or of electricity and magnetism, the other really earlier things that have practical importance as well. I don't think we can claim that cosmology has great practical importance. It's just wonderfully important for science.
But your work does set out to answer or at least confirm some of the great questions people have about the universe in history. For example, how did the universe begin?
Yeah, and I don't think we can answer that yet. I personally think that it's incorrect language to say that it began. When you say it began, we mean that there was nothing and then there was something. But that's not what scientists see. We only see that the universe is expanding and always has been expanding. So the time zero is not included in our universe as far as we know. Only time a little bit after zero is included. So this is like you can get closer and closer to the edge, closer and closer to the beginning, but you can't actually get there. So we have not observed the beginning. We have observed things that are really close, but we have not observed the beginning. So this sort of addresses one of the great worries that people used to have. Intuitively, people do not believe that the universe could have a beginning. It just doesn't feel right. Well, the scientists did not see a beginning either. We only measure the expansion.
Another question is, how did human beings start and why on the planet Earth?
Well, that's another big project of not only astronomy but physics and geology mm-hmm. and biology.
Yeah.
We're getting more information. We know now that the Earth was formed with the sun 4.5 billion years ago and is only one-third of the age of the universe. And it was made from recycled stars, stars that blew up and the material went back out into space and came back and was formed into new planets. We know that the Earth was bombarded by rocks from heaven for hundreds of millions of years, and when that stopped, almost immediately we have fossils that show signs of life. So that suggests that it's maybe not so hard to form life. But then it took another 3.3 billion years before complex life occurred. And we don't know what prompted that. This is a question for biologists. So how come is it that the life can be more or less stationary and constant for 3.3 billion years and then kaboom? We have what they call the Cambrian explosion, and there are trilobites and fishes and sharks and seashells of all sorts, and there was nothing like that before. How come? Nobody knows, and I don't know if we'll ever find out. One of the problems is that our ancestors ate all the evidence.
Yeah.
So if there was another kind of life, we would not probably ever find it. It's one of the things that makes hunting for life on other planets so interesting. Because it could answer the question of, is our kind the only kind that could be, or could many other independent origins occur, and would they come out different? Hmm. So that's a question that it has a lot of personal resonance for a lot of people. We have come a long ways from when we thought we were the center of the universe. Now we sort of know that our star isn't very big, and it's sort of ordinary. But on the other hand, there are billions of stars like the sun and billions of planets, probably a lot like Earth. So it seems a little self-centered to think that we're the only place, that Earth is the only place where people could live, or that intelligent life could live. On the other hand, it's also true that the universe is so vast that we don't think, according to calculation, that we could find any sentient beings out there. We think we could find signs of life on another planet, around another star, because we know what to do to look. And it's just really hard, but we could do it. But finding the place that's got another person out there talking to us, that's pretty hard. Mm-hmm. It's way harder than just finding life.
What can charting the history of the universe do to help us explain the present or even the future of the universe?
Oh, golly. When you look at the past, you can see the kinds of events that occur. You can see the catastrophic events, the chaotic events, the geological events. Our planetary history is one disaster after another. Sort of the most famous one is the asteroid that hit the Earth around the time the dinosaurs died, and we imagine that's the reason they died. The mammals, our ancestors, presumably came into dominance after that. Well, how many other natural catastrophes are there? Well, it's only just over a century ago that a pretty big asteroid hit Siberia and made a big hole in the trees, knocked down the trees for miles around. There's a giant crater in Arizona where you can see the hole that one made. So, you know, catastrophic events have been occurring for a long time, and you think, well, maybe some are going to happen to us. Mostly they happen long ago and far away, and we don't notice or care, but it certainly gives us a lot to think about.
You are a NASA scientist.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you know, a lot of the questions around NASA center on the future of NASA. The space shuttle program recently came to an end. I think a lot of people equate NASA with the space shuttle program. How healthy is NASA right now?
Well, NASA's budget's about the same as it has been. The science program and the human spaceflight program are about the same size budget as always. But the mix of things that we're doing changes from time to time. Right now, astrophysics budget's down. Other science budgets are up a bit in most areas. Although we've just had a magnificent landing of a wonderful probe on Mars, the Mars science budget's down for a while too. So, you know, the details change. But I think the general public's been very supportive for many decades of basic science. It's one of the glories of NASA. And people love people in space as well. Something like 1 million people went to Florida to see John Glenn go into space, though, for his last trip. And, you know, they voted with their feet. They really, really care about people in space. So it's something that's a dream for so many millions of us that the MAN program has strong support, too, in the public. What we're in the process of doing now is a transition from the space shuttle to something else. And we're not quite sure where it's going, but we know that at least one commercial organization has offered us a much lower price than the others used to do for getting people into space. And so we're wishing them luck. The company is called SpaceX, You probably know about it anyway. It was started by the guy who started PayPal. Mm-hmm. And so we're kind of hoping that he succeeds, because it could open up not only for his company but for many the possibility of much cheaper access to space, which is to say a lot more people can go and do things.
You may not have been inspired directly by the space program, but there were thousands of people who were in your generation.
Absolutely, there were.
What is inspiring this the next generation of scientists?
I don't know. I talk to young people, and they're pretty excited about going into it, because it's just a challenge and a pleasure to do science. The experience of discovery is something that it's hard to describe to people, but it's a frontier for us. Maybe you can't walk to a new place on Earth, because all places have been walked to already, but you can discover something nobody ever knew before, and we definitely are not coming to the end of what you can find. Just to me, the big exciting discovery of the last weeks was the discovery of what the dark matter is in genetics. You know, we've now got the whole human genome has been worked out, and your chromosomes string out to be 10 feet long if you stretch them out. And a large fraction of the genetic material had unknown function. They used to call it the dark matter, just an analogy with what we have in astronomy, with something that does something but nobody knows what. And recently they discovered that material of unknown function is actually millions of digital switches that control how the genes are expressed and when and where. So my golly, that's incredible. So I don't know where it's going to go, but it will give us a tremendous amount of power over disease, and it's just tremendously exciting to know something of how our own nature is working.
What are you working on today? Is the COBE satellite work done?
The COBE satellite work was done a long time ago.
Yeah.
My current project is called the James Webb Space Telescope, and it's the successor for the Hubble Space Telescope. Hubble has already been in space since 1990, and so it's 22 years old now,
yeah,
right?
Coming to an end.
It'll sometime come to an end. It's still working beautifully because astronauts have been to it 5 times to upgrade it and service it. But the next time we go to visit, it'll be a robot, and it's to aim it at the Pacific Ocean probably. So that's when it's very old. Mm-hmm. So what are we going to do next? What's the next possible giant thing to do that's going to be even more powerful than Hubble? So astronomers pretty early recognized that the next frontier is called infrared astronomy. The wavelengths a little bit longer than what you see with your eye are tremendously interesting, and until now we didn't have the technology to do anything about it. But those waves come from your body, for instance. You're transmitting 500 watts of infrared power right now and you don't feel it. Anyway, we can study things that are at room temperature because they emit infrared. We can study things from the very distant universe that are even farther away than what Hubble can see, because the wavelengths are too long for Hubble to measure. So there's a tremendous number of scientific opportunities that are open because of the availability of this new technology. And you might say, well, where does the technology come from? We have to say some of it comes from our friends on other government agencies that really needed to see infrared stuff. And so they developed a huge repertoire of new stuff. We've got better detectors. We've got better telescopes. We know how to make cold telescopes. And all of that is now being put together to make this wonderful new telescope, which is much bigger, much more powerful than the Hubble.
Okay. So what is the life expectancy of the James Webb when it does launch?
Well, we're requiring it to work for 5 years. If we're carrying fuel to last for 10 years, and if we're lucky, it could last a lot longer.
So chances are good you will not see all the good things that come from
that's
satellite.
Possible. I could retire now, but I don't want to, because this is such an exciting time in science. But this should last, it's probably another 15, 20 years before we come even close to the end of knowing what it's done. Then the archives of scientific observations will be available for everyone for decades after that.
Right.
So there's probably a half a century's worth of science to come out of this work that we're doing today.
Okay. Is there anything else you want to add?
Oh, I should say that it's that project, the James Webb Telescope, is named for James Webb, the second administrator of NASA. He went up to John Kennedy and said, this is what it takes to get us to the moon. He got it right. And we did get to the moon in under 10 years. That's a fantastic accomplishment. And he said, Mr. Kennedy, we need science too. So this is the first time we've named a telescope after an administrator, but he was a very special person. Also should mention it's an international partnership. The Europeans and the Canadians are chipping in big parts of their budget to make this possible, and they'll get to use the telescope too.
John Mather won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1996 for his work on the COBE satellite, which helped measure radiation from the Big Bang. He spoke with WPR's John Davis during a visit to UW-La Crosse last fall. Thanks for listening to Newsmakers. From Wisconsin Public Radio in La Crosse, I'm Maureen McCollum. Our production team includes John Gatto, Steve Roysom, Mary Meehan Strube, and our senior news editor and producer, John Davis. To hear archives of this or other recent editions of Newsmakers, visit our website at wpr.org/lacrosse. In addition to Newsmakers, you'll find archived reports and special series produced by the La Crosse News Bureau. And if you'd like to comment on this week's Newsmakers, or if you have a suggestion for future shows, you'll also find links to our producers and staff. That and more at wpr.org/lacrosse. Newsmakers is also on Facebook. Updates on future shows, links to our archives, and more. Like us at WPR Newsmakers on Facebook.